From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross.
I have made certain decisions, and they are decisions that you would have to respect.
Today, actress Carey Mulligan joins us. She's nominated for a Tony for her performance opposite Bill Nye in the Broadway revival of Skylight. Mulligan also stars in the film adaptation of Far From the Madding Crowd. Her breakout role was in the film An Education. Also, neurosurgeon Henry Marsh describes what it's like to operate on the brain.
I cut into it with a small scalpel and make a hole through which I push with a fine sucker. As the brain has a consistency of jelly, a sucker is the brain surgeon's principal tool.
Marsh has a new memoir. And Alexis Madrigal reviews the Apple Watch he's been wearing.
The Apple Watch is not what I expected. And yet, I still love the watch. I never want to take it off.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bean Cooley, founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's recent interview with British actress Carey Mulligan, who is up for a Tony Award for her performance in the Broadway revival of the David Hare play Skylight. It's one of seven nominations Skylight has received, including ones for her co-stars Bill Nye and Matthew Beard, and for Best Revival. She also stars in the new film adaptation of the Thomas Hardy novel, Far From the Madding Crowd. In the 2009 film An Education, Mulligan portrayed a studious high school girl led astray by an older man. She's also starred or co-starred in Drive, Shame, The Great Gatsby, Inside Llewyn Davis, and Never Let Me Go. Let's start with a scene from Skylight. Mulligan plays a young woman, around 30, who a few years earlier had a long affair with a much older married man, played by Nye. He's an affluent restaurateur. She's now living alone and teaching in an inner-city school. They haven't seen each other in several years when he shows up unannounced at her apartment. They review the past and consider the present, agreeing on very little. He's critical of the life she's chosen, including her low-rent apartment, which is freezing because the heater is so inefficient.
Tom, you know, there's something which you have to deal with. There's this whole world I'm now in. It's a world with quite different values. The people, the thinking is different. It's not at all like the world which you know. I mean, if we can work out a way of keeping in touch, then you would have to know that I have made certain decisions, and they are decisions that you would have to respect.
Why? I mean, yes.
Good.
Surely, I'm not a complete idiot.
No.
You're saying you've made an informed and serious choice. You've chosen to live in near Arctic conditions, somewhere off the North Circular. No, really, why should I have any problem with that? I promise you, I'm deeply impressed with it. I assure you, it gives me no problem at all. Put a bucket in the corner to and you could take hostages and tell them this is Beirut.
Tom, I have to tell you, this place is really quite reasonable.
Oh, really?
As it happens, I get it at a very cheap rent.
I should hope.
No, it's you, Tom. The fact is, you've lost all sense of reality. This place isn't special. It's not. It's not specially horrible. For God's sake, this is how everyone lives.
Oh, please, please, let's be serious.
No, I mean
no, really, honestly.
No, this is interesting. This is at the heart of it. It wasn't until I left your restaurants, those carpaccio and ricotta stuffed restaurants of yours. It wasn't until I deserted that Chelsea milieu.
Which, in my memory, you liked pretty well.
I do like it. Yes, that's not something I'd ever deny, but it wasn't until I got out of your limousines, till I left that warm bubble of money and good taste in which you exist.
Thank you.
But I remembered that most people live in a way which is altogether different.
Well, of course.
And you have no right to look down on that life.
You're right.
Thank you.
Of course, that's right. However, in one thing, you're different. I do have to say, Akira, in one thing, you're different from everyone else in this part of town.
How is that?
You're the only person who's fought so hard to get into it when everyone else is desperate to get out.
It's my guest, Carey Mulligan, with Bill Nighy in a scene from Skylight. Carey Mulligan, welcome to Fresh Air. Congratulations on your Tony nomination and all the other Tony nominations that the show has received. You know, watching you both perform, Bill Nighy is constantly moving. He's like spinning around and moving his hands, like gesturing constantly. And you're pretty still as you act. And I'm wondering, like, is that anything that's written in? Is that like a directorial choice?
No, it's not written in. I mean, it's the sort of, I mean, a lot of it is just the fact that my character in the first act of the play is cooking a meal. And so I'm sort of in terms of the space that we're inhabiting, I'm generally in the kitchen in one part of it and preparing food. So that sort of keeps me in one place. Also, Bill's character, Tom, comes in and is trying to sort of, I mean, he's telling stories and he's in a sort of big anecdotal kind of, flurry of information, and he's kind of, you know, introducing her back into his life again. And I think he's sort of, you know, that the way that he moves around the stage is all part of his storytelling, is the way that he is. It's his charisma. And so me being in the one place, and I'm sort of his audience for the first act of the play, really.
Have you known a lot of people for which you felt like they were your audience, that you were their audience? I know people like that.
Yeah. You just, you smile and you nod. I think, you know, there's a line at the end of Act One where I say, I'm standing here smiling, nodding, agreeing, you know, and all the while she's thinking, you know, why is this guy, you know, how many lies is he going to tell me in this sort of first meeting?
What did Broadway mean to you when you were growing up in England?
Broadway was sort of the dream. I mean, Broadway was, you know, when I was little, I wanted to be a musical theatre actress. It wasn't, I didn't watch films growing up really more than, you know, normal. I wanted to do musicals. I went to the theatre a lot in London, in the West End with my mum. We saw shows. And then when I was 11, I came out to New York with my family. And I think we saw a show maybe. But when I was 14, we came out, just my mum and I, on a weekend. And we saw a couple of shows, and one of them actually was Cabaret with Alan Cumming and Molly Ringwald then at Studio 54, the same production that's just been revived. And that was sort of it for me. I just sort of, that was what I wanted to do. I wanted to live in New York and be a musical theatre actress. And, and that's sort of where I decided I wanted my whole life to be. So it was very, very surreal coming here for the first time and doing a Broadway show when I did The Seagull when I was younger. And sort of living out that dream, which just felt completely bizarre, because I'd seen a show in that very theatre. I did The Seagull at the Walter Kerr, and I'd seen Kevin Bacon do a one-man show there when I was 14, and I was on the same stage. It was a sort of real pinch me moment.
It's interesting. You know, you wanted to do music theatre. I don't know if you've actually done any music theatre, but you've managed to sing in several of your films. In Far From the Madding Crowd, you sing one of those Come All Ye Fair and Tender Girls kind of songs. In Shame, you sing New York, New York. In An Education, you sing along with a record. So are all of those singing parts written in for you because you have such a lovely voice?
No, they're so completely accidental, really. I mean, I sang in, Shame was the first, well, I think I might have sung in other things, but yeah, Shame was the first time I sang in something, and then I sang in Inside Llewyn Davis, the Coen Brothers film.
Oh, right, I'm leaving that out, yes.
Yeah. they just happened to be, you know, I mean, I loved the challenge of the singing in Shame because it was a very kind of exposing scene, and, and Steve McQueen, obviously, directing it, wanted the whole thing in one take, and he wanted to record it live, and he didn't want to cut out of it, and you know, so it was sort of, it felt like a very kind of big challenge and exciting, and that scene is so much more about the relationship with her and her brother than actually the song. So I never had a strong enough voice really to do musical theatre proper, so that's why sort of as I got slightly older in my teen years, I decided to focus more on straight sort of theatre acting. But
wait, let me stop you. When you say you didn't have a strong enough voice, do you mean like a big enough voice? Or
yeah, I think it was, you know, I can sort of sing in tune, and but I'm not, so I can't really belt out a song in the way that, you know, you need to be a musical theatre actress, you know, proper. And I can't dance, which is also a bit of a requirement. I've got absolutely no rhythm. So, so after a while, I sort of figured that out. But it was something I just loved doing when I was growing up.
Okay, so we have to hear you sing in Shame. And you know, New York is usually sung as this kind of anthem. You know, the implication is if I can make it there, I can make it anywhere. And somebody like determined to succeed and so on. Your version is the opposite. You're singing here somebody who's like struggling with depression, who's lost a lot in your life, and if you don't make it here, it's like this might be the end of the road for you.
Yeah.
So
exactly.
I've never heard it sung like this. It's really an amazing version. So let's hear it. This is Carrie Mulligan in the film Shame.
Start spreading the news. I'm leaving today. I wanna be a part of it. New York, New doesn't sleep and find I'm king of the hill, top of the hill. These vagabond shoes.
That's Carrie Mulligan singing in the film Shame. And what's going on in this? You're singing in a club. You're wearing this, you know, you look very sexy in it. Your brother, played by Michael Fassbender, is in the audience staring at you. And his boss is sitting there, too, looking at you longingly. So it is such like a loaded scene, and it's such a depressive version.
Yeah.
How did you decide to approach the song that way?
Well, that was a lot. I mean, that was Steve, really.
Steve McQueen,
the director, had that vision for the song from the beginning. And it's described in that way in the script of this sort of, it's like you said, it's her last-ditch attempt at life, really. And coming to New York to be with her brother is her sort of last attempt to try and have a connection and stay alive, really. And she's struggling so much. And she's reaching out for love pretty much anywhere where she can get it. So, you know, I think the song begins to break her brother's heart, and then of course his leery boss is sitting there, and she ends up, you know, bringing him home. And so, yeah, it was an incredibly dark film. But that scene particularly was sort of a turning point in the film where it all sort of starts to break down.
There's a scene in Shame I want to ask you about. It's a nude scene. And this is a scene like you've just moved in to your brother's house without asking him or anything. You had a key. You surprise him. He comes home. He thinks a burglar's been in his house. He takes his baseball bat ready to like whack someone. And he finds you. And you're in the shower. And you do not cover your body. And he has, it seems like he's seen your body before, which is why there, one of the reasons why there is this hint that something perhaps incestuous went on between you way in the past that's going to remain unspoken, but that's going to affect everything about your relationship. And so, like, you're on screen full body, naked for a few seconds, and your character's attitude is like, here I am. And he's saying like cover yourself. He throws a towel at you, and it's a powerful scene because it has so much meaning beneath the surface. Mm-hmm. It's not just like, oh, it's a sexy shot. It's like you're communicating by being naked like that with your brother. What kind of thinking for you went into whether you wanted to do that or not? I think it's a really big deal for an actress to do that.
Yeah, I mean it was sort of never really a consideration. I mean, I'd never done anything like it before. You know, I wouldn't go to a public swimming pool and put on a swimming costume. I hate wearing, you know, I never wear a dress that's above the knee. I'm completely kind of, I'm a complete prude. And I'd avoided it in other jobs, and I'd said no to jobs where there was gratuitous nudity and, you know. But it never felt like that to me. That felt like the perfect introduction to her character. That is exactly who she is. She has absolutely no qualms about being naked in front of her brother for whatever reason. She's not ashamed of her body, or at least in that moment she's not. And it never sort of felt like a big thing. I wasn't meant to. She's an alcoholic. She's not meant to look good. I spent the weeks before filming that, you know, just eating whatever I wanted to and drinking beer, and that felt who she was, and it felt like the only way to introduce her into the story and that Steve had written, and so it didn't really bother me ever, and in fact it didn't really bother me when we were filming it. I remember a couple of days later he said, you know, do you want to watch the rushes of that just to sort of approve it or whatever and say that you're happy? I think it was part of some clause in my contract that I could have approval or whatever. And I just said, no, like, that's fine. I approve it. I don't need to see it, you know, because I think that's just how you feel when you really trust a director. You don't need to watch anything. You just go, well, if he thinks it's the right thing, then it's the right thing. And I definitely felt that with Steve.
No, I have to say, I love hearing you speak. you have a beautiful speaking voice as well as a beautiful singing voice. And I'm just going to play one more clip here. You are currently starring in Far From the Madding Crowd, which is a film adaptation of the Thomas Hardy novel, which is set in the late 1800s. And you play a woman who is an orphan, who's living... It's a relative that you're living with, right?
Yeah, an aunt, yeah.
An aunt. And then you find out, you know, you yourself don't have anything, and then you find out that another relative has died and bequeathed you their farm. So suddenly you're a landowner. You are now the boss of all the workers on the farm. You're a young woman in an era in which women really usually are not property holders or bosses, and you're taking on this responsibility and doing it with considerable confidence and authority. So here you are introducing yourself basically to the farm workers and telling them what to expect.
From now on, you have a mistress, not a master. I don't yet know my talents in farming, but I shall do my best. Don't suppose because I'm a woman I don't know the difference between bad goings on and good. I shall be up before you are awake. I shall be afield before you are up. It is my intention to astonish you all. Back to work, please.
So, did you have to speak any differently for this period movie?
No, actually. Well, I mean, you know, a little bit here and there. On the whole, Thomas Vinterberg directed us in that adaptation, who directed Festen and The Hunt. And as a Danish director coming in, having an outsider's sort of perspective on Victorian British literature and that kind of film, wasn't overly concerned with being proper. And, you know, I think sometimes I find it limiting and sort of alienating when characters in a film, in a period film, speak in a way that's sort of, you know, very much probably very accurate at that time, but that feels sort of forced, because it sort of feels like you're separating yourself. And I think I was only ever interested in doing a costume drama if it felt that these characters were relatable to a modern audience, that you could look at them now and think, oh, I know that person, or I understand that feeling. And I think when people are wearing costumes and putting on accents, sometimes you sort of separate, and it's something more that you look at than you feel. And so we, accent wise on that film, and if we were being really authentic, we would have done Dorset accents, because they're all from Dorset. But we didn't, and we did sort of a received pronunciation British accent. But it was definitely, the whole feel of the film felt a sort of relaxed version of a costume drama. It was never going to feel sort of buttoned up and proper.
Like a lot of people, I was introduced to your work in the film in Education, which came out in 2009, but it's set in, is it 1961?
Yeah.
And you play a girl who is finishing high school. You have to wear like a school uniform every day. And you're a very good student. You're really smart. You're the kind of student every English teacher wants to have. But you also want adventure, and you want to be sophisticated. And like a lot of girls, you make the mistake of thinking that that's going to come to you through a man. Your idea of an adventure is to go along with this older man who's played by Peter Sarsgaard, who is obviously trying to seduce you, but you're kind of naive, and he's playing on that. And the first time you meet him, you're standing in the rain with your cello, because you're also in the school orchestra, and you're waiting for the bus in the pouring rain, and he drives by in his car and says, look, you should never get into a car with a strange man, but your cello is going to be ruined, so put your cello in the car. And you could just walk along beside the car. And then you do, and then you eventually are so wet, you decide to, like, get in with him. He seems like a nice guy. He's been talking to you. And this is the conversation that you both have.
I suppose cellists must go to a lot of concerts.
We don't go to any concerts. We don't believe in them.
Oh, they're real.
So people say.
Smoke?
I'd better not. I live just up there.
Why don't we believe in them?
You'd say there's no point to them.
For father, this is.
Oh, yes. They're just for fun. Apart from school concerts, which are no fun at all, so we go to those. They don't help you get on.
Which, of course, is what's so wonderful about them. Anyway, you'll go one day.
I know, I will. If I get to university, I'm going to read what I want and listen to what I want, and I'm going to look at paintings and watch French films, and I'm going to talk to people who know lots about lots.
Good for you.
Yes.
Which university?
Oxford, if I'm lucky.
It's my guest, Carey Mulligan, with Peter Sarsgaard in a scene from early in the 2009 film An Education. So I read Nick Hornby's saying that he wrote the screenplay for An Education, which was adapted from a memoir, right? So what he said, that you told him that the first time you saw An Education, you cried and cried. Why were you crying?
Oh, it was a bizarre thing. I saw it in L.A. on my own in a room, and it was the first time I'd seen it. And it was the first time I'd seen myself on screen for that amount of time. And I just thought it was so, I just found myself so unbelievably boring. And I thought, I don't do anything with my face. I don't, you know, my voice sounds monotone the whole way through. I just had this complete meltdown that, like, it was just incredibly dull and no one would want to watch me for 90 minutes, you know, playing this character. And yeah, it was just a bizarre, it was, you know, and actually I don't enjoy watching myself on screen. And I now only ever watch the film that I'm in once, unless it's sort of on a festival circuit where we have to sit through the screenings. But, you know, I just watch it once and then that's it, and it's great. And it's not really about watching it for me, it's about the whole experience of making it. But it was just the first time I'd seen myself on screen that much, and I just was kind of horrified. But I could definitely, you know, I definitely recognised what a beautiful film Lone had made, and that, you know, it was all...
In spite of your shabby performance.
In spite of that, yeah, disaster. But yeah, you know, it's just, it's like listening to yourself on oh, you must, you know, listening to yourself,
I know.
Listening to your own voice. It's a sort of bizarre experience.
Yeah. Do you feel like if you watch too much of yourself, it will make you self-conscious and interfere with your ability to perform?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I never, ever watch rushes on set. I don't watch playback. I watch the film once, and that's sort of enough. And there's so many things to pick apart about your performance or, you know, what you look like and all of these things. And I think it ultimately makes you self-aware and makes you second-guess your instincts. And I think the more you can rely on your instincts, the better.
Carey Mulligan is nominated for a Tony for her performance in the play Skylight, which is currently playing at the Golden Theater in New York. Mulligan also stars in the new film adaptation of Far From the Madding Crowd. The Apple Watch has been one of the most highly anticipated devices of the decade. Billed as Apple's latest revolutionary product, the watch is a screen on your wrist with its own operating system and software. And as our technology contributor Alexis Madrigal explains, it just might steal back some of your time from the attention-hogging phone in your pocket.
The Apple Watch is not what I expected. Yes, it's beautiful. You can stand in the shower and watch water bounce off the screen as if it were a lotus leaf. The details of the hardware can be stunning like that. But most of the features that really excited me when the watch was introduced have turned out to be disappointments. As a physical activity tracker, it's mediocre. The messaging system, which Apple seemingly lavished attention on, is no better than regular old texting. The hyped crown scroll wheel for navigation is a rarely used flourish. And yet, I still love the watch. I never want to take it off. It's a secondary device, a powerful extension of what your phone can do, and so you must have an iPhone to use an Apple Watch. The watch uses the phone's data network to do any and everything. With a glance, I can see the time, the date, my next calendar appointment, the temperature, my day's physical activity, and the watch's battery level. So why do I love it? It lets me do the business of communicating without the temptations that come with my phone. That was Apple's pitch in the weeks leading up to the launch in late April, that this would be a device that gives you back time and even focused attention. I was skeptical, given that its primary function is to notify you that stuff is going on your phone, and yet it does work. Before I got the watch, every text message or notification was an opportunity for prolonged distraction. I had to pull out my phone, and once it was out, what was there to prevent me from checking my Facebook page or Twitter or Instagram or maybe all of them? With the watch, the message comes in, and I can deal solely with it, without those other icons tempting me. And the watch parses incoming messages, anticipates my response, and provides a few contextual answers, like, I'm on my way, if someone says, are you there yet? Or yes and no, when it detects that kind of incoming question. The computer's textual interpretation is not that deep, but it doesn't have to be to give genuinely useful options. Between the auto responses and using voice to text, I find I don't need to type anything for most of the exchanges that I have during the day. The voice to text feature is particularly impressive. As long as the answer isn't too complex, the watch handles most text message level communications with ease. When you sync your watch and phone, watch apps that correspond to your phone apps just appear. And the genius of the watch is that its apps work differently from the ones on your mobile device. Each tends to deliver a single function through the watch. If it's Uber, that function is to call a car. If it's Trulia, it's to look for home listings right around you. If it's ESPN, it's to give you scores for your favorite teams. Bloated apps get stripped down to their essential utility. The single-serving app is a radical idea, and it doesn't always work well. The Twitter app lets you read the 5 most recent tweets in your feed. It feels silly. Instagram's app, on the other hand, is almost a recreation of its phone app, and it feels bulky. While many people worried about the watch's battery life, I can say that it's good enough to easily make it through a day, maybe 2 with light use, and charging is rapid. But what I did not anticipate was how much of a drain the watch would be on my phone. I still have an iPhone 5S, a phone that's a little over a year old, and it hasn't made it a full day since I got the watch, even on days when I'm not using it heavily. One night, I went to bed with the watch on, and my phone next to me at 100% charge. When I woke up 7 hours later, despite not having touched my phone or my watch, my phone's battery life had dropped to 69%. That's a lot of battery to lose for a night's worth of idle chatter between my watch and phone. In fact, the watch has taken such a toll on my phone's battery that I bought one of those cases that contains an extra battery. If you've got an older phone model, expect similar problems. Unlike the smartphone, which transformed the way I did just about everything, the Apple Watch slid into my life seamlessly. Within days, it had become an essential part of how I communicate with others and parse my days. The watch is not the revolution that the iPhone was. Rather, it's a reaction to the power and addictiveness of our phones. A helpful supplementary tool to manage my own psychology. And for me at least, that's been worth the price.
Alexis Madrigal is a visiting scholar at Berkeley's Center for Science, Technology, Medicine, and Society, and is the editor-in-chief of the Fusion Cable and Digital Network. Coming up, neurosurgeon Henry Marsh describes what it's like to operate on the brain. This is Fresh Air Weekend. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with neurosurgeon Henry Marsh. Marsh has opened heads, cut into brains, and performed the most delicate and risky surgeries on the part of the body that controls everything – breathing, movement, memory, consciousness. In his work, Dr. Marsh has fixed aneurysms and spinal problems, but now he mostly operates on brain tumors. In his new memoir, Do No Harm, Dr. Marsh discusses some of his most challenging cases, the triumphs and failures, and confesses to the fears and uncertainties with which he's dealt. He explains the surgical instruments he uses and how procedures have changed since he started practicing, and he reflects on the state of his profession and the mysteries of the brain and consciousness. Marsh has been a consulting neurosurgeon at Atkinson Morley's St. George's Hospital in London since 1987. He was the subject of the Emmy Award-winning 2007 documentary The English Surgeon, which followed him in Ukraine, trying to help patients and improve conditions at a rundown hospital.
Dr. Henry Marsh, welcome to Fresh Air. The first thing I'd like you to do, since the book is so well written, is to read the opening paragraph. I don't think you could put this description of an aspect of brain surgery any better than you did in this paragraph, so why don't you just read it for us?
I often have to cut into the brain, and it is something I hate doing. With a pair of diathermy forceps, I coagulate the beautiful and intricate red blood vessels that lie on the brain's shining surface. I cut into it with a small scalpel and make a hole through which I push with a fine sucker. As the brain has a consistency of jelly, a sucker is the brain surgeon's principal tool. I look down my operating microscope, feeling my way downwards through the soft white substance of the brain, searching for the tumour. The idea that my sucker is moving through thought itself, through emotion and reason, that memories, dreams, and reflections should consist of jelly, is simply too strange to understand. All I can see in front of me is matter. Yet I know that if I stray into the wrong area, into what neurosurgeons call eloquent brain, I'll be faced by a damaged and disabled patient when I go round to the recovery ward after the operation to see what I've achieved.
That's Henry Marsh reading from the opening paragraph of his new memoir, Do No Harm, Stories of Life, Death, and Brain Surgery. You mentioned in the reading you just did the sucker, which is a tool that you use. What is it?
Well, it's a microscopic vacuum cleaner. If you're actually operating on the substance of the brain itself, you don't sort of cut it or stitch it or burn it. You simply run over this very thin metal tube, the internal diameter is about 2 millimeters, through the substance of the part of the brain you're operating on.
So you describe in the book a little bit about what you have to do when you're opening up the head for surgery, and one of the things you have to do for some surgeries is drill a hole in the skull, and it's just, you know, for someone who's never had brain surgery and certainly never performed it, it's just so hard to imagine having a hole drilled in your head, a hole that leaves blood and dust that has to be cleaned up.
Yes, it's very physical, isn't it? But I mean, if you have a serious medical problem and you trust the doctor, in my experience, most people put up with it. They're frightened, but they know that the alternative is worse. But what is, I think, peculiar about brain surgery is it's so dangerous, because very small area of damage to the brain can cause catastrophic disability for the patient. You can damage you can nick the liver, you can remove bits of the lung, you can remove bits of the heart, and the organ goes on working. But with the brain, although some areas can suffer some damage without terrible consequences for the patient, in general terms, it's very dangerous, which means the decision-making is very important. And in what, as I write in my book, in my experience over the years, when things have gone wrong, it's not because of a one sort of cut the wrong blood vessel or dropped an instrument or something like that. If there were mistakes made, the mistakes were in the decision-making, the decision whether to operate or when to operate.
The brain does not experience pain, even though it communicates pain. It registers
pain. Well, it creates
pain.
Pain is a lot of what we think is real and obvious, in fact, is what you could call an illusion, in a way. If I've got pain in my hand, the pain's not actually in the hand. The pain is in my brain, created. My brain creates a three-dimensional model of the world, and it associates the nerve impulses coming from the pain receptors in my hand with pain in the hand. Then it creates this illusion that the pain's actually in the hand itself when it isn't. The more you look into neuroscience, the more strange and sort of confusing it becomes.
Usually, or at least often, when you perform brain surgery, the patient is just under a local anesthetic because...
Well, for certain sorts of tumour, tumours called low-grade gliomas, which are tumours of the brain itself, which grow very slowly and which look very much like brain tissue. And you want to try to remove as much of a tumour as possible. But given that the tumour looks like the brain, and if you're operating near what we call eloquent brain, that is brain where if it's damaged, the patient suffers serious trouble, such as paralysis or inability to speak, something like that. It can be very helpful to have the patient awake, talking or moving the relevant limbs as you remove the tumour to make sure you're not doing any harm. And I was one of the first people to do this in this country many years ago and was considered rather eccentric at the time. But in fact, it's now a standard way of operating on these tumours and is practised everywhere. And patients, on the whole, tolerate it very well. The idea sounds outlandish, but I've very rarely had, in fact, only two or three times out of hundreds of operations, have I found patients couldn't cope with it.
Can you explain why it is that pain, as you put it, is created by the brain, and yet when you're performing surgery, you can do that with just a local anesthetic because...
Well, because the brain has no pain receptors in it. Pain is produced by stimulation of peripheral nerves in the body, which then send electrical signals to the brain, and the brain then will interpret that particular pattern of nerve signals as a painful experience. The brain itself has no pain receptors, so it can't feel anything. If the brain felt pain, you'd have to have another brain somewhere registering the pain in the first brain. There's an infinite regression.
That's an interesting thought. So sometimes your patients watch their brain surgery on a video monitor because
yes,
they're actually
awake.
Yes,
because I have a camera attached to the microscope, and so mainly so the other medical staff and nurses can see the operation, see what I'm seeing on a television screen. But it means the patient can as well if they wish. And I will ask my patients, do you want to see your own brain? And some of them say yes, and some say no. And if they say yes, I'll say, well, you're now going to be one of the few members of the human race who has ever actually seen their own brain. And it's a strange thing to experience. I've actually had, when operating on the visual areas of the brain with the patient awake, at the back of the brain, I've had some of my patients, the visual cortex looking at itself on a television screen.
Wow.
And you feel that somehow there should be a philosophical equivalent of acoustic feedback. You know, something should explode or give way. It's just so weird, but of course it doesn't.
Do patients who you're trying to keep awake ever pass out because of what they're seeing on the video monitor?
No.
If you're just joining us, my guest is neurosurgeon Dr. Henry Marsh, who's written a new memoir called Do No Harm. Let me quote something you read in the book. You write, neuroscience tells us that it's highly improbable that we have souls, as everything
yes,
we think and feel is no more or less than the electrochemical chatter of our nerve cells. So does the work that you do as a neurosurgeon increase or diminish your sense of the mystery of consciousness?
It increases it. It's become more, I mean, it's something I took for granted when I was younger. And when I was a medical student, I found the neurophysiology and the neuroanatomy the most interesting part of my studies, although it took a while before the penny dropped and I fell off my donkey and decided I was going to become a neurosurgeon. But in a sense, this sense of awe and mystery, for some reason, has got greater as I've got older. I'm not quite sure why. Maybe because many of us, as we get older, we start thinking more about, you know, the fact our life is going to come to an end, and we become a bit more religious and philosophical. And if you don't have conventional religious belief, as I don't, I think, you know, in a way, thinking about the mystery of one's own consciousness and the universe is a sort of compensation for that in some ways.
The operation that you're performing at the beginning of the book, and this is the operation you start to describe in the reading that you did at the beginning of our interview, you're trying to remove a tumor from the pineal gland of your of your patient.
Yes.
And you're lucky with this one because the tumor comes out easily and it's benign. But you're very nervous, as you describe it, during this procedure because you just recently performed surgery removing a tumor.
Which had gone very badly. Yes,
yes, from the spinal cord of a woman. And she was left paralyzed on one side of her body. You fear that you removed too much of the tumor and that's what damaged her spinal cord. And you confessed to several times when you felt responsible for spinal or brain damage as a result of a surgery. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in why you wanted to share that. You've even given a lecture called, like, the 10 worst mistakes I've ever made.
Well, something like that. I'm a great believer that doctors and patients should, in a sense, be equals. I mean, as specialists, we give advice. I've always hated sort of paternalistic, condescending doctors. And I'm all for patients making demands and patients' rights. But it's a two-way process. And I think patients in the modern world, where certainly in England you can't open the newspapers without reading about the latest medical scandal and incompetent doctors, now it's incompetent nurses. The public need to understand that medicine actually is often a very uncertain process. It's not like going to a car dealer and buying a car or getting things fixed. It's very uncertain. It's very difficult. And there's a lot of talk in this country, as there is in the States, about duty of candor and guilt-free culture and transparency. And I thought, well, I'm going to write a book, which is based on a diary I've kept all my life, which shows what it's really like, you know, with no holds barred, both the good things and the bad things. And again, some of my operations are great triumphs, and tremendous. But they're only triumphs because they're also disasters. If all operations were easy and safe and straightforward, there'd be nothing very special about them. So although one could accuse me of frightening the public, I think on the whole, if you, as a patient, if you go and see a doctor and you could only choose one quality, I think most of us would go for honesty. Because if you see an honest doctor, If he knows what should be done, he'll tell you. If he thinks somebody else can do it better than he can tell you. And I think honesty is, in a sense, a more important quality than steady hands or nerves of steel or heart of a lion, all the old cliched ideas of what surgeons should be like.
In confessing to some mistakes you made, you paraphrase a French surgeon who once described the cemetery that all surgeons carry within themselves. You feel like you carry around that cemetery?
Yes, I think so. I think all surgeons do, and if you're honest. And the longer you've been in practice, the bigger the cemetery. I had a very, very large surgical practice. I haven't retired fully. I was operating last week, in fact. And as the years go by, you accumulate more problems because it's the nature of the work. It is intrinsically dangerous. I have little time for people to talk about aiming for zero harm in medicine. I think it's nonsense. Yes, we should try to. Clearly, we want to minimize harm. We should never be complacent about bad results, but they're going to happen. It's the nature of the work.
Are there times when you'd like to see the patient die because you think that if they live, they will be so incapacitated?
Yes.
So
I think there are many things worse than death when it comes to brain damage.
So what comes into play legally and ethically for you if you think this patient should be allowed to die?
I've never had a problem in my practice of that nature. First of all, if somebody's brain dead, which is a different state of it, if the brain has died, you can there are fairly clear cut ways of diagnosing that. If somebody's on a breathing machine, on a life support machine, and there's no cerebral activity, we know the heart will stop within the next few days, usually. So discontinuing treatment is only shortening the inevitable. The problems arise with people in persistent coma. If you treat a severe head injury, the phrase is aggressively, you tied them. In the past, all these patients died. They died usually from pneumonia because they were in a coma. They couldn't cope with their own secretions and they'd get pneumonia in the lungs. And now all that is treated acutely, so they survive. And some of these patients, months or even years later, the family will say, well, actually, we wish they hadn't. Although at the time, of course, they probably said everything must be done, we must hope. And then it puts the doctors in a difficult position because one's never entirely certain. You see somebody with a bad head injury and a bad-looking brain scan, you're pretty sure they're going to be left very disabled if they survive. But you're not absolutely certain. And the way to illustrate the difficulty is, and when I'm on call for emergencies, I'll be telephoned by the hospital by my juniors who do the emergency surgery, because it's technically very simple most of the time. And I'll be sent a brain scan over the internet. And let's say if somebody shows a big head injury, big blood clot in the brain, where if we don't operate, the patient will almost certainly die. And if we do operate, we'll probably save the patient's life, but they may or may not be left very disabled. Now, if I, like Nero at the Roman Games, if I say thumbs up, operate, I get back to sleep. If I say thumbs down, don't operate, the patient's better off dead, I don't get back to sleep because I'm worried I might be wrong. And there is this built-in ratchet. It's always easier to treat than not to treat. Not to treat means you expose yourself to anxiety and doubt, and you also actually have to have a much longer, more difficult and painful and honest conversation with the family, which is often very difficult at sort of 2 o'clock in the morning in the context of an acute emergency. So there's no question of the fact that modern treatment of strokes and head injuries does generate quite a large population of profoundly disabled people. And I suppose the view is, well, it's justified by the fact we have a few good results. But I do wonder sometimes.
In your memoir, you attribute the end of your first marriage, which lasted, I think, about 27 years, in part to your profession, not only because neurosurgery kept you so busy and preoccupied, but also because of the arrogance that came along with it?
I think the sense of self-importance, yes, I think so. I mean, it's hard to know. There are other factors as well. But, I mean, it was 20 years ago now. The world is a rather different place. But, I mean, for all the years of our marriage, my work always came first. And that, I think, was not helpful.
But
it was good for my patients.
Can you talk about that sense of self-importance?
Well, just if you spend the whole day dealing with life and death issues, it makes you impatient of other things. It makes you impatient of bureaucracy at work. It makes you impatient of domestic problems because you're in a permanent state of often anxiety, arousal, you know, patients. It's life and death. It's like soldiers in battle. Everything else seems rather trivial by comparison.
Dr. Henry Marsh is the author of the new memoir, Do No Harm, Stories of Life, Death, and Brain Surgery. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Terry online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Adam Stanishevsky. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.